today on Against the Grain, a look at this thing called theory, with a focus on Friedrich Nietzsche and Stuart Hall. I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Lawrence Grossberg about his book On the Way to Theory, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Lawrence Grossberg loves theory. He taught it for decades at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the University of Illinois. In his new book, On the Way to Theory, Grossberg introduces the reader to major ways of thinking that have provided the backstory for contemporary Western theory. Much of the book is devoted to laying out the ideas and perspectives of major figures in the Western philosophical tradition, including Descartes, Kant, Hegel, Marx, Heidegger, and Foucault. Lawrence Grossberg is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Communication at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He and I agreed to focus on two thinkers, Nietzsche and Stuart Hall. When Larry and I connected recently, I asked what he meant by the word theory.
I guess I mean the systematic and reflective use of concepts in the attempt to organize the empirical world in meaningful ways.
And of course, that would encompass a lot. So what kind of theory are you focusing on in this book?
Well, I'm focusing on the moment that began in the post-war era in the 1950s, largely but not entirely in the academy, when there was an explosion of different a variety of conceptual systems offered as ways to make sense of human social life in opposition to the extraordinary power, which still existed and still does today, of the more narrow forms of theory that define the physical and, by mimicry, the biological sciences. So in the 1950s beginning, but then the 60s, 70s, and then exploding in the 80s and on, there emerged an entire universe of systematic and reflective systems of concepts which attempted to make sense of the specificity of human social life. What I'm trying to do in this book is provide what I think is the background that people interested in that explosion of theory, which surrounds us these days, you know, when even the New York Times can drop the word postmodernism or poststructuralism or deconstruction or any of a myriad of theoretical concepts developed in the academy, I wanted to provide what I thought was the background necessary to understand the ways of thinking out of which this explosion, this myriad of different conceptual systems emerged. I wanted to focus on the ways of thinking, what I call the deep theories, underlying those conceptual systems.
So we agreed to talk about two thinkers discussed in this book. The two thinkers are Nietzsche and Stuart Hall. So let's start with Nietzsche. He was born in Prussia in 1844. He grew up in a deeply religious household. He began his studies in theology, but then moved to the study of languages, to philology. In 1869, he became the youngest ever chair of classical philology at the University of Basel. So he was a sort of a rock star. His books were published in the 1870s and 1880s. Big question to begin this. How different was Nietzsche from the thinkers who came before him?
Well, let me put it this way. Nietzsche was very different from what has been constructed as the mainstream of post-Enlightenment and modern philosophy. There were thinkers outside the mainstream, people like Spinoza or Leibniz or Schopenhauer, with whom Nietzsche had much greater affinities. Nietzsche was not necessarily deeply aware of them. He discovered Spinoza only very late in his life. He was very different from the dominant traditions of what I guess we would call Western philosophy of the 19th century, the modern philosophy, as we now call it, which was dominated by Kantian and Hegelian traditions. He had some affinities with Kant, he had some affinities with Hegel, but he also rejected fundamental assumptions which he saw as continuing the Enlightenment search for truth and shot off in his own direction, for the most part embodied not only in his thinking but in his writing practice as well, and even in the ways he understood his own project. He understood his project as he described it, writing for the future. He did not think that he was writing a philosophy for the present age, his present age. He thought he was writing a philosophy for people who might in the future understand what he was saying.
Is this partly because he did not think that the masses of his time could understand what he was saying, could understand the truth that he thought he was delivering?
Well, yes, and because he thought they believed in truth. He thought they were driven because they were, in its latest form, ruled by the Enlightenment's will to truth. They could not understand that there was no truth, that there was no universal morality. In one sense, his philosophy is a rejection of the Enlightenment of the 18th century and the will to truth that he sees as the essence of the Enlightenment. On the other hand, it's a rejection of a much longer tradition of Western philosophy. Well, Western is no longer the right descriptor. It's a rejection of a much longer tradition that he traces back to Socrates, and the kind of humanism that he sees in Greek philosophy. Socrates is a much more difficult figure for him because it's more about the way in which Socrates was read than actually Socrates himself, in which it's a celebration of the weak over the strong. It's a celebration of moralities of suffering and subordination over moralities of strength and creativity. He sees these as the traditions that his society, especially German society, has inherited, and he stands opposed to both that long tradition and the Enlightenment tradition. He sees himself trying to announce the coming end of that tradition.
Yeah, this understanding of maybe mainstream morality is elevating weakness over strength. To what degree did he see that as associated with the Judeo-Christian worldview?
The Judeo-Christian worldview is one of its manifestations. He saw it associated with socialism. He saw it associated with Stoicism. He saw it associated with all the dominant, he calls them perspectives. You know, it's not quite the same, but Marxists might refer to them as ideologies. All of the dominant ways of understanding the world that have defined the West, for Nietzsche, all of them celebrated the strength that comes only from the unity of the weak, not from the strength of the creativity of the individual. And that includes the will to truth, which is the latest version of this kind of morality, what he called the herd morality.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Lawrence Grossberg is my guest. He is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Communication at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's written a number of books, including Cultural Studies in the Future Tense, and he co-edited the book Without Guarantees in honor of Stuart Hall. We are talking about his new book. It's called On the Way to Theory. You'll find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. So, fair to say that in opposition to the will to truth that he rejected, he forwarded the will to power?
Well, now we get into why Nietzsche, for me at least, in the context of this book, is so interesting. You know, all of these ways of thinking that I describe as deep theories have many variations and many arguments amongst them. None is so visible and so blatant as Nietzsche. The disagreements among Nietzscheans are so absolutely clear and vividly drawn. And that's partly because Nietzsche wrote different texts at different moments, and in different texts, he introduced different concepts. So the will to power, which many people who read Nietzsche today think of as his major contribution, only appears in his very last works. Some people then read that back into his early works, and I'm not the one to say that that's wrong. I'm merely to say, realize that's what you're doing. On the other hand, there are people who read the early works and read Nietzsche as an existentialist, as a precursor to Jean-Paul Sartre and Camus. And they read those early works into the later works. When I was taught Nietzsche as an undergraduate by Walter Kaufmann, he was an existentialist. The will to power was a kind of footnote to Nietzsche, not the major concept. Nietzsche has been read as an existentialist, an anarchist, a Marxist, a postmodernist. The readings keep multiplying, and they are radically contradictory. I find that interesting. And what I tried to do in that chapter is make visible how that's possible. Make visible the fundamental chord structure, if you will, that enables all of these different symphonies to arise out of the same texts.
Well, how about this note then, to continue this metaphor? Because you do linger and come back to a note, and the note being that Nietzsche advocated for and admired the expression of a natural creative energy. Is that a fair thing to say, and would most Nietzsche scholars agree with that?
I think what most Nietzsche scholars would agree to is that at the center of Nietzsche's philosophy is some concept of creativity as a natural event, as something more than a human action or a human intention. In his early works, when he's writing about tragedy, for example, and he's close to Wagner and Wagner's second wife, he's still writing about creativity, and he's still writing about the conflict between reason, Apollo, and the full creativity of the Dionysian. It's still about creativity and the need for creativity. Does he yet see it as a universal energy? Well, I mean, he doesn't describe it that way until later in his writings. Can you read his early writings from those later works and say this is what he was moving towards? Yes, and people do that. But you can also say, yeah, but in his later writings, he was insane. He was suffering from literal insanity. So maybe going that way wasn't what we should be doing. Maybe we should stick with the more humanistic and less ontological. After all, there is a contradiction in Nietzsche that one might struggle with. I'm trying not to offer my reading. I have a reading of Nietzsche, which when I gave lectures, I would on the side tell my students. I try not to do that in the book. But there is a contradiction. For most of his life, Nietzsche said, there is no truth. Truth is a lie about which we have forgotten that it is a lie. But at the end of his life, when he begins talking about the will to power, he sure does seem to write as if that is the truth with a capital T. I am not trying to tell people how to read Nietzsche as if there is a right way of reading Nietzsche. I am trying to tell people, look, here's where you have to start. Here's the ground on which Nietzsche's philosophy has to be read.
You mentioned Schopenhauer. What did Nietzsche take from what Schopenhauer asserted about the meaning of or lack of meaning of life?
At the very least, he took from Schopenhauer a profound sense of pessimism on the meaninglessness of human life. And even further, on the meaninglessness of the universe. The idea of the will, which Nietzsche eventually reappropriates as the will to power, is an idea from Schopenhauer, although Schopenhauer's will is very different from Nietzsche's. Schopenhauer thought the universe existed without purpose, without intention. It is often said of Schopenhauer that he thought of human life, he compared it to a certain worm, which is born underground, burrows its way to the top, crawls a few inches, burrows its way back into the ground, lays its egg, dies. The eggs hatch, feed off of its mother, I suppose, burrow their way to the top, move a few inches, burrow their way back into the ground, lay their eggs. And that's his sort of pessimistic image of life and the universe. But Schopenhauer, like Nietzsche, is often also read as an existentialist. This is Sartre. Humans live in a meaningless universe. For Sartre, the only thing you have is the choice you make in every immediate instance. Schopenhauer didn't have that. Sartre read that on top of a kind of Schopenhauerian pessimism. Nietzsche took a different route out of it. It's hard to know exactly who and how Nietzsche was influenced by. He didn't keep prodigious scholarly notes that are available to him, and many of his notes were either edited or destroyed by his family.
So what was Nietzsche's route out of Schopenhauer's pessimism? In other words, how did Nietzsche avoid the conclusion that the meaninglessness of human life and of the universe led, or could lead only to despair?
Well, it comes back to creativity. At a general level, Nietzsche thought that we had reached the end times in what he described as passive nihilism. The search for truth had led us to the realization that there was no truth. The search for God has led us to the realization that there is no God. The search for moral certainty had led us to the realization that there is no moral certainty. Passive nihilism. All that we have built is a failure. All we can do is tear down everything we have built, is to accept that truth is a lie, turn passive nihilism into active nihilism. That is what Zarathustra comes down the mountain to tell the masses, that they must turn passive nihilism into active nihilism and destroy the will to truth, destroy the will to a universal morality, etc. And that will open the door to creativity. That will open the door to the Übermensch. The Übermensch is not, you know, some Nazi or some military figure or some dictator. The Übermensch is the creative force. The Übermensch is the person who understands that his or her being in the world is the being of creativity, that it is he or her who creates truth, who creates morality, who creates beauty, right? It's all about creativity. That's how Nietzsche escapes. And that's why he is writing for the future. Because, you know, while there have been individuals who have understood this, who have lived this, Socrates, Jesus are amongst the people he names, the masses can't understand it. They can't understand it until their passive nihilism has been turned into an active nihilism and the way has been cleared for the Übermensch to live the creative life. Socrates did, but of course they had to kill him. Right? It wasn't just the legal system coming down on Socrates. It was that Socrates was the fully creative being, answerable only to his own creativity. They killed him for it.
Lawrence Grossberg is my guest, distinguished professor emeritus of communication at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His new book is On the Way to Theory. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Let's turn to another thinker discussed in your book, Stuart Hall, born almost a century after Nietzsche in 1932 in Jamaica, immigrated to England in 1951, so he was about 20 years old, with prestigious scholarships to study literature. What did this shift in location mean for his a sense of belonging or non-belonging, and how did that affect his theorizing?
That's a very good question. And Stewart has written a book, a kind of strange, beautiful autobiography about it. It affected, I want to say it affected it in two ways. The first way is because it imposed a kind of sense of displacement, of not belonging in any one place. Something like what Du Bois called double consciousness. Something like what Stewart calls diasporic thinking, where there is no home to which one comfortably belongs. I think this was an experience not only for Stewart coming from the Caribbean to England, where he didn't feel like he belonged in Jamaica and he didn't feel like he belonged in England, but he felt disconnected. He felt like he was caught in the transversal between them. I think this was true of people who had a certain uncomfortable mobility. For example, the Welsh literary historian Raymond Williams, who was a close friend of Stewart's and an intellectual interlocutor of Stewart's for many decades, who moved from the Welsh mining towns like Stewart to Oxbridge, and has written about the fact that he didn't belong in the Welsh mining town and he didn't belong in Oxbridge. He lived between two worlds, as one of his novels is called. That sense of displacement, I think, is a important constitutive part of the way of thinking that Stewart brings to bear, that defines his particular sense of what it means to think about human reality. It also brings, the second thing I think it influences is a crucial sense that the problem with Western thinking, and for Stewart that's probably too big a category, but the problem with the traditions of thinking that he inherited and was educated in, the inheritance of the various enlightenments that Nietzsche had rebelled against, was its attempt to universalize. If Nietzsche thought the problem was the search for truth and the search for morality, a moral truth, I think Stewart thought the problem with the Enlightenments was its search for a universal truth. And it drove him more and more to think that the only way you could understand human social life was to think about it contextually.
So context is so important to Stewart Hall. So was he saying that you can't generalize across different contexts, that something, let's say, racism, that some phenomenon in some place and time can be or is necessarily different than the same phenomenon or the word we would use, the same word would we use in another context?
Yes. Or he would say, maybe I shouldn't say, he would say, what I suggest is that Stewart's position, I use his first name because he was my teacher and friend, Stewart's position was, don't assume something operates across context. Don't assume that the meaning of race or the reality of race in 1950s America is the same as the reality of race in 1950s Britain or the reality of race in 2020s America. Do not assume that the forms of racism operating are the same. There are many different kinds of racism, and there are many different forms of race. Stewart famously said, and it is largely ignored by audiences in the US, he famously said, I am not offering a general theory of race and racism. I am offering a theory of a society that is raced. And he was writing about, in his most famous collectively authored work, Policing the Crisis, he was writing about England in the second half of the 1970s. He goes on to say, what is progressive in the 1970s as an anti-racist strategy may not be progressive in the 1980s. You must do the work of analyzing, understanding the context in order to understand the political struggles that need to be waged. Right? He is, I suggest in the book, the most consistently radical contextualist philosopher, you know, or at least one of them, that one can identify. My friend John Clark, also a student of Stewart's, when people offer a reading of an essay by Stewart, and he wrote almost only essays, he wrote one co-authored book. When they read an essay by Stewart, John Clark likes to ask them, do you know who Stewart was arguing with? Because every essay Stewart wrote was an intervention into a context and an argument with people over how to construct that context. What was going on in the context? What theoretical tools, what concepts would be most useful for coming to terms with that context? So his most radical position, I think, was that he thought theory was contextual, rather than think that you could look for a theory, whether it's Marxism or Derridian or what have you, and apply it to a context. Stewart thought theories were themselves contextual. So the question to ask or to grapple with or to wrestle with when you were concerned with analyzing, let's say, America in the past 20 years is what theoretical concepts are going to be useful. And you might bring concepts to bear and find that they don't tell you anything interesting or useful. And then you got to go find other theoretical concepts to use.
That's the voice of Lawrence Grossberg. He is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Communication at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His new book is On the Way to Theory. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Let me ask you about Stuart Hall's understanding of power and how it relates to culture, right? So, among many other things, Hall really focused and saw a great importance, assigned a great importance to culture. Maybe you could define what Hall meant by the word culture and how he saw culture as being deployed, put to use by power and also by resistance to power.
It's the one word he never actually defined in all of his work. Let's say culture is all of the ways in which human reality is made intelligible and livable and experienceable. Now, that includes systems of meaning and signification, but it also includes systems of differentiation. It includes systems of emotional organization. It includes systems of psychoanalytic organization of desire, all of the ways, and they function usually through discourse. That is, through systems, as Foucault says, and Stewart cites Foucault frequently, at a distance. You know, unlike guns or forms of physical power, discourse, cultural power functions at a distance. It doesn't have to immediately touch the body. It functions through discursive figures, signs, whatever you want to call them. It is not the narrow sense of culture as a body of texts, although it includes those. It certainly includes those, but it includes all of the ways in which we make sense of the world as a livable set of experiences. And when I say make sense, I don't mean only meanings and representations. Yes, we do give meanings to the world, and we do represent the world, and that affects how we live in it. But we also decide that things, some things matter and some things don't. We also have all sorts of moods that affect how we live in the world. We have emotions, we have desires, we have all sorts of ways that we make sense of the world and make it livable. We do that discursively, we do it culturally. You know, it's not for nothing that Breitbart, you know, the right-wing news online service, has as their motto, politics is downstream from culture. Culture is how we live in the world. Culture is what shapes how we live in the world. Raymond Williams, whom I mentioned before, defined culture by saying it's the relations amongst all the elements in the whole way of life. That's not a very useful definition, but it begins to capture something. Culture is what binds everything together into a livable reality. It's how we know that we live in a world that makes sense and that we're not crazy. Now, as far as your question about power in relation to culture, power is also a contextual reality for Hall. That is, you can't know in advance how power is operating and what forms of power are the pertinent questions that need to be observed, described, understood, and resisted. Resistance and domination are always questions to be asked and not assumed. You can't go into a situation for Stewart and assume that what you're observing is a matter of racism or sexism without analysis, but you also can't go in and assume that power is operating at the level of social difference. It may be operating at the level of micropower, as Foucault described it, or it might be operating at the level of class power, or it might be operating at the level of economic distributions, or at the level of the distribution of emotional resources. But in the end, all of those forms of power exist only in relationship of culture. It is culture which makes power manifest, which actualizes power in our lives. The separation of economy, social relations, politics, and culture was an invention of the Enlightenment. they don't exist separately. Culture permeates the economy, politics, and social relations, just as the economy permeates social relations, culture, and politics. They are interconnected. It is culture that makes them livable. So you can't separate culture and power. There is no power without culture, right? And there is no culture that exists without power. Not all power is bad, as Foucault argued, and as Stewart has argued, power is sometimes enabling. The question is always, what are the relations that are producing power in such a way that it is making contexts that are deeply inhumane, that are producing relations in which people suffering becomes something that is normalized, right? But that isn't the universal definition of power. Power is not oppression to be resisted. There is not a dichotomy of power and resistance. There are complex contextual relations between forms of power and forms of resistance, and they can only be understood and enacted through a better understanding of the complexities of the context.
So we've been focusing on just two thinkers, profiled, discussed, analyzed, commented on in my guest's book, On the Way to Theory by Lawrence Grossberg. What can you tell us, Larry, about some of the other thinkers and strands of theory that you have chosen to address in this book?
What I've tried to do is construct two not quite parallel histories. One is a history of what is commonly thought of as the Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment or modern philosophy. I argue that we should recognize that the notion that there was such a thing as the Enlightenment is not a useful starting point, that the Enlightenment was itself a more complicated and contentious set of ideas and ways of thinking. But I'm not trying in this book to make my own arguments about the history of philosophy or about any particular philosophy as a way of thinking, a deep theory. I want to, as I said, lay out, as it were, the chord progressions that I think people need to have. Like when you learn when you start learning rock and roll guitar, there are certain chord progressions you need to learn. And once you get those chord progressions, then you could start playing with them. So I do trace, you know, I do begin with the debate between rationalism, and I talk about Descartes, and empiricism, and I talk about some of the major empiricists, especially David Hume. But then I spend a much longer time talking about the work of Immanuel Kant, who is really, I suggest, the first modern philosopher and the first philosopher who introduced the two major concepts that define modern philosophy. One is that reality is relational, that relations are the substance, if you will, of human existence. And the second is that in some way, human existence is constructed out of those relations. And so it's in Kant that we find the beginnings of those two concepts, which continue to be, I think, the major concepts of much of contemporary philosophizing, of deep theory, and of contemporary theory. The other major thinker of the Enlightenment, whom I spend probably too much time, perhaps one of the more difficult deep theorists to understand, is Hegel. And of course, Hegel is the deep theorist who, more than anyone, introduced the concept of time and history into our way of thinking. But Hegel also was the first philosopher in this tradition to begin to chip away at the notion of universality. If Kant thought that there was some way to define universal truth and a universal essence to humanity, Hegel thought that that universal could only be found at the end of history, but along the way, there was going to be more of a multiplicity, and hence more of a sense of a kind of beginnings of relativism that Hegel introduced into possibility as a way of thinking. Following upon Hegel, of course, is the work of Karl Marx. And Marx, following upon Hegel, famously turns Hegel on his head. But most importantly, Marx introduces the question of power into deep theory. I'll leave it at that. And then following Marx, Nietzsche, whom we've talked about, and Freud, continue that and continue the question of power, thinking about it in relationship to human existence, Nietzsche through the will to power and Freud through a psychoanalytic model of human existence. The response to these kind of trends of the introduction of power, the introduction of the beginnings of relativism that Hegel and some of his followers introduced, was a return to the search for certainty, which led to phenomenology. And I talk about Husserl and Husserl's search for a science, a philosophy of certainty. And I talk about Heidegger's attempt to find an ontological foundation for deep theory of human existence. I then turn to a series of philosophers who focus on language and make language itself the center of human social existence, including pragmatism, the later work of Ludwig Wittgenstein, structuralism, especially the French structuralists, and their theory of the relation of language and subjectivity, and some of the early postmodernists, such as Baudrillard. And then I turn to ontology and ontologies of language, returning to the later works of Heidegger and his emphasis on the creativity of the universe, Derrida's emphasis on language as the creation of difference, and Deleuze's attempt to think about difference as a fully ontological creative act that defines existence itself. I did leave out someone who becomes quite crucial, and I take him up again, and that is the work of Spinoza, who for most of the 19th century is read as a rationalist in the tradition of Descartes, but who is taken up in the 1960s particularly by Deleuze as a Nietzschean, as an alternative to the Enlightenment tradition, as an anti-Enlightenment, anti-humanist, ontological theorist of the creativity of the universe. And finally, I turn to a series of figures whom I think stand against the attempt of the Enlightenment to universalize deep theory. And I talk about the work of Deleuze and Guattari, which I think is very different from Deleuze's ontological deep theories. I talk about the work of Michel Foucault and his theories of power. And finally, I talk about the work of Stuart Hall. All of these people, I try to suggest, offer different versions of a kind of radical contextualism, each of which is, of course, like all of the positions, open to many different interpretations. And all I've done is to provide you with the chord structure of their own ways of thinking.
Lawrence Grossberg, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Communication at UNC Chapel Hill. His books include Cultural Studies in the Future Tense, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, Popular Conservatism and Postmodern Culture, and Under the Cover of Chaos, Trump and the Battle for the American Right. We've been talking about his new book, On the Way to Theory. It's published by Duke University Press. Larry, congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that interview was recorded on December 5th, 2024. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.